Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with
Year-long
my Science Hour for March 3rd,
2022,
in the ongoing series of biographical expose of my discoveries. This week, starting what I call the Cornell years, the 2 years I spent, 2 academic years I spent at Cornell. And this is something, let me just preface this by saying, when I walked across campus that day, walked up to the physics department, and was actually applying to be a grad student. They told me, no, you don't, we're booked up here. It's really tough to get into, but you can teach here. And I was offered a teaching job. I had no clue that, I had no idea what I was about to happen, setting me on a worldwide stage, nor did I have any idea of the hornet's nest that I had just stepped into. I was green behind the ears when I walked in there, but the thing I had was my theoretical work, which I had been working on for a very long time. And also, all of these, I talked in weeks past about the 1970s and the convergence, all of the things that were happening that converged on that, literally almost that same day when I was offered a teaching job. And at that time, NASA was a little naive, you might say, about the handling of data. And they had all of the data available there. It was in the Space Science Library. It was in the Physics Library and the Astrophysics Library. And the data that was coming in from the Voyager spacecraft were open meetings. So at the end of the day, after classes and after regular school hours, etc., all of the space scientists, etc., from NASA, and there was probably 50 of them, to give you an idea, would meet up in an auditorium room and with a giant, giant screen up in front where they would give the day's data from the spacecraft, all the different spacecraft. One would present, then the next one, then the next one. So it was an absolutely rich environment to look at this. And so I'm sitting there realizing that this data is coming in. I'm realizing that I'm seeing my theoretical work that I've been working on for years coming out in the data. And then I realize these NASA scientists, supposedly the top scientists in the world, have no idea what they're doing. And I'm like, wow, these guys don't have a clue. And so that's when I started work on publishing my papers, etc. But the first thing I'm going to do is go through a litany here of people who I met and some of the places I went when I was on campus. And just to start off, Ithaca is the most wonderful little town to house a major world-class university like Cornell, Ivy League school, one of arguably one of the best schools in the world, well-known, of course. And when you get at this level, they're all good. They all have their, you know, their Nobel Prize winning list, etc. All of these universities keep a list of people who have been associated with Nobel Prizes and other prizes, etc. But at any rate, I'm going to go through the names of people that I met and talked to their scientists, and also things like the old library, which I understand isn't there. I have not been back to Cornell physically since 1981, the spring semester when I left there, and I'll be talking about that and all the incidents that led up to that. But the old library was amazing. It had a big rotunda, a big round room where there were stacks, there were books, etc., and then there were other stacks, and then, of course, there was the new library, which was a Library of Congress. It had stacks going down deep into the ground, and then the main library. But the place where I sat a lot of the time where I did my work was in the old library in the rotunda. And it was there were not many students there. There were not many students that came in there. And if they did, they were quiet. These students had high pressure on them to succeed. And you can imagine being at a university where every student was probably a 4.0 in high school, and then you had students that were flunking out because they couldn't keep up with the level of competition there. And I'll say also one of the hidden things there was the suicide rate among students, because of this intense pressure. And the family, you know, the families, the uncle went to Cornell, the dad went to Cornell, the mom maybe went to Cornell, the grandfather went to Cornell, and here comes Junior and has a 4.0 average in high school and is flunking out of Cornell because he just can't make it. And well, I was coming out of campus, just to give you an idea. And this sets the tone for the high-pressure school that this is. I'm coming out of campus, and there's a bridge that you have to cross. It's like a walking bridge, and cars, it's like a bridge also for cars. But it's a stone bridge, a very old stone bridge. And sitting on the edge of the bridge, like a railing, a big wide railing, was a student. And there were a bunch of students around him going, no, no, don't, trying to prevent this student from jumping off. And then all of a sudden, I saw the student push himself and down into the ravine and the gorges of Ithaca, these very deep ravines where the rivers run through. And you know that as soon as that student went off there, he was dead. This was the level of pressure on the undergraduates. And I was like, oh, my goodness. You know, so a very high level of pressure on the students and on the professional staff there to get grants, to get grant money, because that's your ability to stay there, is to get outside money coming in. And I don't care. The math department was a lot less stringent on that, and they were involved in mathematics departments typically don't get that much funding in terms of relative to, say, the astronomy department or the physics department or the astrophysics department, where they had real money coming in, serious money from the National Science Foundation, other government institutions, private money coming in, going into the endowment, where these corporations would send money to Cornell to do studies. And so I would say probably about 80% of the people that were physically at Cornell were not teaching. They were not involved in education. But at any rate, a very high-level place. And, of course, I'm in the physics department teaching introductory courses and involved in laboratories with introductory courses, etc. Just gives you a tone of what things were like. And every noon, exactly at noon, the Cornell, what would you call it, song would play with bells. Do, 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 do. And this would go on, and it was probably a couple minutes, and the students would be walking across campus, and on a beautiful day, it just came alive with all the students walking across the quad in the center of the campus, an Ivy League school. And I got to know a lot of the students there. And, of course, I wasn't. They were paranoid that I was going to talk to the students, and I really had no interest in talking to the students about my work. I was kind of off in a place. I couldn't even talk to the professors about my work because they had their minds made up on all of this gibberish science that NASA was trying to promote and still is promoting. But that just gives you somewhat of the theme of what it was like to be there on campus for a couple of years. And then I got to know graduate students also. Very, very wonderful environment. Very wonderful environment, but a very stifling environment once you got up to the level of astronomy. And it was like a pyramid in which the astronomy department ruled. They were like king on high, and Carl Sagan, who was the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy there, which is a chair, you know, a bona fide recognized chair. And if you're familiar, if you're not familiar with what a chair is like a position, given an honorary position of somebody who is a well-known person. And so Carl Sagan is the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy, which is high level. And, of course, he got that because he took Belikovsky to the cleaners. He organized science. He became the person that carried the banner at the 1974 American Association for the Advancement of Science ridiculing of Velikovsky, where he organized scientists from all these different disciplines, Stephen Jay Gould, and I just won't go through that whole thing. You can read about that. A very good book on that is Charles Ginnenthal, published in 1995, an excellent book recounting that whole time period. And it's Velikovsky versus Sagan, or Sagan versus Velikovsky. I forget which order it is, but you can find that online. Charles Ginnenthal, a guy that did an excellent, excellent recounting of that whole time period. Okay, so, but like I say, when I was at Cornell, I didn't know who Velikovsky was. I did not know that Carl Sagan had taken him to the cleaners, and that's why Carl Sagan got to be such a notoriety in the world of science. I did not know at the time he was off in Hollywood. Well, I did. There was well known he was making the Cosmos series, but I didn't know that he got that position because of the roasting of Velikovsky. He organized the scientific community. And that was a big thing because the science community from 1950, when Velikovsky came out, it was a thorn in their side. Here you got a guy living at Princeton, friends with Albert Einstein, Velikovsky, and he is writing books that are sold in 14 different languages, top-selling book on the New York Times best-selling list for years, not days, not a week, not a month, like most best-selling books, and then they're replaced by the next one. No, for years, Worlds in Collision, Earth in Upheaval, Ages in Chaos, Velikovsky's three main books are bestsellers. And so at any rate, when I finally found out about Velikovsky, I was out of Cornell, and I was talking to a friend of mine about what I was doing and my research on comets becoming planets, and he goes, well, you know, you sound like this. You're saying things like this Velikovsky guy. And I said, well, who's Velikovsky? And so I went and looked it up, and that's when the whole universe of Velikovsky was opened up to me. But anyway, this was kind of the structure at Cornell. And so the physics department, the space science department, NASA was all literally controlled not from Harvard, not from Princeton, not from Caltech, not from UCLA, but from Cornell, with Carl Sagan as the pinnacle, the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy at Cornell as the pinnacle on this pyramid of Western knowledge, and all other sciences, including geology, anthropology, meteorology, whatever it was, it had to conform with this idea that there was a Big Bang and that the universe began with this Big Bang, and then biological evolution was an imperative also in this. And if you now, it's something you should do when you have a few extra seconds is go look at my education program, because I do about 15 shows, our lectures, taking apart Cosmos series by Carl Sagan and his succession scientist Neil deGrasse Tyson. We did the Cosmos series a number of years ago, but I do about probably close to 20 hour lectures taking apart each one of Carl Sagan's episodes of Cosmos, breaking it down and telling you the errors he made, the mistakes, in building it back up and telling you the real story based on my theoretical work that comets are not dirty snowballs, that the universe has electrical activity, and the universe did not begin in a Big Bang. And then the problems with evolution, biological evolution, has serious, serious problems. And the way it's put together. Now, anyway, I'm not going to go into that right now, but the point here is to talk about the structure of the world of knowledge. Everything had to fall under this timeline of events given to us by the astronomy department at Cornell. And the reason this was important for scientists is because they did not have structure. when Velikovsky first came out with his books in 1950, they were massively bestsellers. It was originally published by Macmillan, and because of the kickback from the science community, this is in 1950, long, long before Sagan ever dreamt of coming along and picking his nose in public. But the scientific community was asked. They were outraged, but the news media came to them and they said, well, okay, you're outraged, but what's your story? What is your story? And they didn't have one. That's when the Fred Whipple 1950, also the Fred Whipple ice ball comet model came along and gained favor. But this whole consortium of concepts in physics and cosmology, the Hubble constant and the expanding universe, you know, none of this had been solidified. And it was Carl Sagan who brought this all together, all of the different fields, into one composite set of concepts. And once they did that in 1974, and this was all in response to Velikovsky. If it weren't for Velikovsky, the entire scientific community would have been adrift in the ocean, as it had been for the past literally 74 years since the turn of the century, when Edwin Hubble first got good telescopes, was the first one to see galaxies and organized structures in the universe, was the first one to put a spectrometer on a telescope and see the redshift in the line spectrum of the elements coming from these, and everything was redshifted, so that's where the Hubble expanding universe concept came from, not realizing that and of course what they used was Einstein's newly established special relativity redshift that indicated that everything was moving away from us. It wasn't until I came along and showed, well, no, this was due to the induced electric dipole redshift, a concept that I pioneered. And by the way, that is one of the, if I should get a Nobel Prize for anything, it should be for that. That covers subatomic physics, where the pair production of a photon, of an X-ray photon coming near a massive nucleus, the electric field of a massive nucleus, non-uniform electric field, I should add, causes the photon to break up, and you get a charge pair. You get the positron and you get the electron, and they have a positive, one has a positive charge and one has a negative charge. And the masses, the positron has an antimatter equivalent to the electron positive regular matter, you might call it. And if they come back together, they form the photon again. But what happened to the charge? You know, nobody could ever figure that out. And so what I figured it out is that charge pair was still in the photon, and it could be separated by an induced electric dipole force. And that's what was causing the redshift and the bending of light, not general relativity. So anyway, that's just a little side note. But all of this scientific structure that had existed piecemeal never was put together. And so it was Sagan who said, we've got to organize here, get rid of this Velikovsky thing, thorn in our side. And this, remember, from 1950, when Worlds in Collision first came out, it had been a bestseller internationally, and people were reading it and believing it and not believing this standard science stuff. So it was 1974. Sagan mounts the expedition to the American Association for the Advancement of Science and buries Velikovsky. 2 years later, Velikovsky is dead, is ridiculed by as a crazy old man. Velikovsky is surrounded by well-intentioned but kind of off-the-wall people, and I got to know a lot of those people, very sincere, a lot of them, and some real hacks also. But anyway, be that as it may, they just contributed to the nuttiness of Velikovsky. And of course, there was a strict, absolutely strict party line that Velikovsky had been proven wrong. There was no need to talk about it anymore. And I come into Cornell, which is the pinnacle of all Western knowledge, which I say is the top of the absolute pyramid. And this includes all the universities in the world, space agencies, etc. And it is literally Carl Sagan is the top man on the heap on the pyramid. And so I walk into Cornell, start publishing my work, showing that comets are not dirty snowballs, that they can become large and become planets. And like I say, can you imagine, like, this is like coming into the middle of a fine party and puking in the middle of the ballroom. You know, it was not welcome. Let's just put it that way. So the extreme level of reaction, and now the other little part of this that you have to know is that all of this time, there is a, this is what I call tier two science. And of course, I didn't know at that time either when I walked in. And how old was I there? Let me just give you a time frame of my age. I am at that time 31 years old. And so 30, just call it 30 years old. And so young and green behind the ears, believing that science is true and pure, and that, you know, having no clue about the politicization of science, but also going on at the same time and going back to literally World War II and before, was the tier one level science going on. And of course, what I found out, because these people, once I started making my discoveries and publishing, and once I became well known, I was very well known at Cornell. Everybody knew who I was. not in the good sense, but as Henry Ford once said, say anything about Ford, just say Ford. And so literally, by the time my 2 years were done at Cornell, and they threw me out of there for the second time for publishing my papers in my work, believe me, everybody knew me. Especially in the faculty and in all of the departments, and I'll explain more about that. But yeah, it was quite the rocky road, and but it was something that established me on a world stage. At this point, my articles were being published in European journals. The row at Cornell was public. I'm criticizing NASA scientists publicly on campus for hiding data, doctoring data, throwing away data, sweeping data under the rug, and to protect their pet theories. And yeah, so everybody knew me. And then once I went out into the wider world after Cornell, I was invited to Los Alamos. I was invited to many public speaking events, and within a year, I was in Los Angeles working with venture capital groups to raise money for my electromagnetic propulsion systems. And so, as I said, why would you invent an electromagnetic propulsion system if you didn't know about electromagnetic conditions in outer space? There would be no reason for that. And so, anyway, my point is that I was well known in Tier 1 science. And these people came out and talked to me because I was solving things that they had previously not understood. I was solving physical problems. I was capping off what Tesla did. And of course, Tesla died in 1943. And so he died well before the space age. He died without understanding the solar wind, or what caused the vertical electric field that he was tapping into at the Wardenclyffe Tower, or his Colorado Springs experiment. Tesla just didn't have that information. So what I did is I found out where that voltage was coming from. And so that, to Tier 1 science, is a major, major discovery. And there again, potentially another Nobel Prize-winning discovery on the list of items that I had discovered. And then secondarily, also, not secondarily, but also the work of Einstein, where Einstein died in 1954 and was working on the unification of the fields. And what I showed is that the electric and magnetic fields were separate and that they affected the light in the electromagnetic radiation and not gravity. So the general relativity, as Einstein had stated, was incorrect. There are some good parts of general relativity, like the space-time, warped space-time as a way of viewing Newtonian space, and tensor analysis, etc., those mathematical tools that allow you to look into three-dimensional space that is warped by gravity. But at any rate, those are the things that I was cracking finally in the idea that a photon had any photon, not just high-energy photons, but any photon had a charge pair and it could be separated. And that separation of charge within the photon in a non-uniform electric field is what caused the redshift and other subatomic phenomena with light. And also the wave, it also discussed, had to do with the wave nature of life and the light and the particle nature of light, because the photons had both particle nature and wave nature that were accounted for by this charge pair. So anyway, these are major discoveries and, of course, never recognized because the people that I was dealing with at the time I was at Cornell were purely Tier 2 scientists. They didn't know, and, you know, Sagan and the other people I'll be mentioning here in a minute really were very, very poor scientists. Okay, so I'm going to continue with my discussion of people that, and this is not a complete list, I'll be talking more about various other people, but I mentioned the Noon at Cornell, which is, if you're at Cornell, then that's part of your life, the Noon Medley, and the old library. I wanted to mention that in the Rotunda Room because it was like a channel for me into the universe. When I was doing my theoretical work and the data's coming in and I'm already have my bank of theoretical work that I have accomplished, and I'm putting this together and it's all making sense now. It's all coming together, the electrical nature of the universe, and also that electricity in space is very subtle. It only works on the smallest things and up to about the something the size of a tennis ball. And so the things that Sagan said about Velikovsky were just patently false, that big planets would go flying around. And no, these were very subtle concepts, and I had them worked out. That's where I also ran into a lot of the books that I referenced when my three-part comet paper that was part of the 300-page book. And so I'll start with that, talking about the book that I wrote when I first got to Cornell. I realized I'm onto something here, and I realized that nobody else there had a clue. I set about writing a book, and it's a 300-page book, and it ultimately was never published. But it was the basis. It gave me the organization for the individual papers that then were published in peer-reviewed astrophysics journals. But a person there who was a secretary, Marie Jones, she was an elderly lady. She had some health problems, I think probably for sitting for many decades. But she was Carl Sagan's private secretary for a while. And so she was also a secretary in the physics department. I think when I knew her, she was a secretary in the physics department. But I would go out to her trailer home outside of Ithaca, a poor lady. I mean, she lived on a pauper salary. She was an excellent secretary. Now, this is back in the days of typewriters. And when you submitted an article or a book or something like that for publication, it had to be flawless. There couldn't be any like white out or type overs or anything like that. So if she made a mistake in the middle of the last word of the last sentence on the page, she had to retype the whole page. But anyway, she was very good, and she typed my 300-page book. And she typed all the papers that I had written and were the ones that were being published in astrophysics journals. But anyway, she had a lot of comments about the physics department and Carl Sagan, and nobody liked Carl. He was kind of like a little, I'll just say he ruled the roost. And he was noted amongst his graduate students for taking their work and publishing it under his own name. So Carl had hundreds, 300-400 publications, I believe, when he was these years at Cornell, but most of it was taken from graduate students, the work of graduate students. And that was the modus operandi of the day, by the way. That was the way things worked. And the graduate student was basically left without a voice. But anyway, she also, one time I asked her, I said, Marie, I said, I go into the Space Science Library, I go into the any of the libraries, which I spent a lot of time in there. Cornell, of course, had the old library, then it had the new library, which was the Library of Congress, then it had the Physics Library, Space Science Library, and then there was the Math Library when I was in the Math Department. But the I asked Marie, I said, why do I never see any of these hoity-toity NASA space scientists over in the Space Science Library? She says, oh, they're too important. They know everything already. If they want a journal article or something like that, they send a secretary. And I used to see the secretaries in the library, and they'd be over there fishing around for an article, and they'd get something, and they'd walk back. But the professors... a lot of these cases, they were not professors. They were research NASA scientists that lived at Cornell, basically were housed at Cornell. They made big money, but they were doing research, and that gave NASA gave Cornell a big name also as being a NASA repository of data. So all of the NASA data was at Cornell. So I had this gold mine of information. Eventually, NASA tied the string on that after they realized that I was getting data and basically using it to prove them incorrect. They tightened the noose on that data, and eventually it got down to, well, the principal investigators get it for the duration of the experiment. And then it was like, oh, well, they get the principal investigators get it for 3 months, and then the data will be released to the public. And then it was 6 months, and then it was a year, and then never. And by this time, and also in that interim, they would say that the principal investigators don't have to release the raw data. They release the massaged data that they deem necessary to support their argument. So basically, they would doctor the data to fit what they wanted, and then they would release it. But a lot slipped through, and I had to become an expert at looking at the data to see the electromagnetic effects, etc. And it's something I did. But like I say, Marie Jones told me, she said, oh no, those professors are too important. They would not be seen in the library. They already know everything, and they would only get a selective article by sending their secretary over to the library. Okay, so anyway... the stacks at Cornell, like I say, this was a Library of Congress. It was a repository not only of the current spacecraft that were going out with NASA, but all of the spacecraft. And so a few people, a few names, do a little name dropping here. The head of the physics department who hired me and then let me go after the first semester because I was publishing papers that they didn't like was Doug Fitchin. And like I said before, once he got wind of me trying to publish papers in the physics department, he called in a resource, Betty Richardson, who was a professor there. She dealt with undergrad physics classes. In fact, I think she had to do with some textbooks, physics textbooks that were eventually published through the Cornell system. I don't know all the details, but anyway, so she was a professor there. Her job was to shadow me anytime I was on campus. So when I would walk onto campus in the morning, walk into that classroom, Betty was there. If I walked across campus to eat, Betty was there. If I walked back to the lab for an afternoon lab, Betty was there. And the students would ask her questions, and they didn't really realize her job there was not to deal with students, but to watch me. And when Doug Fitchin called me into his office, very angry, extremely angry, because now in retrospect I can understand that the astronomy department came down on him and said, you have an employee there, one of your instructors, and by the way, I still have my Cornell faculty card. I've kept that just as a token of a momentum of my being there, my faculty card. And so anyway, he called me into his office, and you've probably heard this story if you heard my lectures before. But and the way this happened, by the way, is I was in an electronics course. That was my very first assignment, one of them, besides physics 101 and things like that, but my very first assignment. And they hired me because I was able to teach in a bilingual setting. That was one of the things that they really liked about me. That's why they hired me, because I had been teaching physics, mathematics, and computer science in a bilingual setting for 4 years. I talked about that in my preparation. And so they needed me to teach there because I was able to manage in a bilingual setting. And so anyway, the way this happened, the way this came down is I was in an electronics lab and my job was to oversee the lab, like a second level physics that probably be for sophomore physics majors that would be taking this, or maybe an elective of people who were in some other kind of program, maybe a pre-med or something like this. But anyway, it was a higher level electronics course. So it was not freshmen, it was maybe sophomores, juniors, could have been seniors, some seniors even. But they, my job was to organize the bins where these experiments were. So week one would be in one column of bins, and there would might be 10 of these experimental setups, and all the wires were cut, all of the equipment, the electronics, if they needed a transistor, it was already there with the ABC three legs of the transistor labeled or whatever it was. And then all of the different experiments for the entire semester were there. And so when one pack of students got done with their experiment, they would come in and put it in their bin. And then the next pack of students from the electronics course would come in, and all of that experimental equipment had to be kept in order. So when the students came in, they had a two-hour period in the lab where they plugged everything together, took their measurements, and left. And I made the comment to the head of this, who this was his pride and joy, this very well-organized electronics lab. And I said, you know, this is not a learning experience. I said, when I went to college, we made our experiments. We had to go find the right wire size and cut it and strip the ends. And if there was a rheostat, we had to spec it out. And if there was a transistor, we had to go find the correct transistor and wire it into the circuit board. And, you know, we literally made our own circuit boards. That's how much detail we did when I was in college in my laboratories, et cetera, during my physics major. So I told this guy, I don't think this is a learning experience. They come in, they just like a cookbook, they plug everything together, it works, they take their measurement, they walk out. And wow, did I, you know, talk about saying the wrong thing. This really, really upset him. But I also told him that I was working on some electrical, this was a electronics professor there, and at Cornell. And I also mentioned that I was publishing some papers on electromagnetism in the cosmos. And so he said, oh, well, let me take a look at them. So I gave him some copies of my pre-publication papers. He takes them up to the space science department and end up on the desk of Carl Sagan and other people up there in the astronomy department, and then they come down to Doug Fitchin, chairman of the physics department, and ride him. They ride herd on him in saying, you got to get this guy out of here because he's using our data to try and prove that basically that comets are not dirty snowballs, that they can become planets. And so by the time Doug Fitchin calls me into his office to like pull the rug out from under me relative to my publications and everything, he already had worked with Betty Richardson to tail me. And he told me that when he met with me, and he was really angry. I mean, when I came into his office, he wasn't just like, Jim, you're publishing this, you can't do it anymore. No, he was furious. And now I know why, because the astronomy department, who's, like I say, is the pyramid on the hill of the whole world of science, came in and rode herd on him, and he's the head of the physics department, and it was his job to make sure this never happened again. And so anyway, I come into his office, and I'm like, hello, what do you want? he called me into his office, and he goes, "What's this?" And he's really, I mean, he's angry. This guy is ready to rip my jugular vein out, angry. And I said, "Well, it looks like you have my papers on your desk." He goes, "Yes, and you cannot use Cornell's name anymore. You cannot, you cannot publish this material anymore." And he said, "I would fire you, but I need you. I need you to teach your class. So I can't fire you. So what's going to happen is Dr. Betty Richardson is going to be with you all the time you're on campus, and you cannot talk to students about this, what you're doing." And I'm like, "Wow, okay." And so that's how that came down. It was through this electronics professor that took my papers, and he was just very congenial. "Oh, yeah, let me see them." And, of course, he hated my guts by this point, so he wanted me out of there too. And so anyway, I had fallen into this this kind of mess. And then at the end of the first semester, this is the fall semester 1979, I was feeling the heat. So I went over and took up, instead of having my office in the physics department, I went across campus and I got an office, kind of a place to be, so to speak, in the math department. And when the next semester came, I got hired in the math department because they needed me to teach calculus. They needed a person to teach calculus classes, and I had just been doing that once again in a multilingual setting, and so I got hired in the math department. And so anyway, that's how all of that came down. So Doug Fitchin was the chairman of the physics department. The electronics professor, I forget his name. I don't remember it offhand. Then math department, Professor Dr. Wolfgang Fuchs, was the chairman of the mathematics department, and he was a congenial, very nice elderly gentleman. And he was very happy that I was publishing in astrophysics journals. He said, "You're the only person in the history of Cornell Math Department who has published in astrophysics peer-reviewed journals." And I was like, I mean, can you imagine that? The whole history of Cornell, the math department, not a single professor had ever accomplished that, and I did. So he also had a son there that was in the physics department and a very good math student also. But he was a student. He was a grad student when I was there. I remember that. And then there were other people around Cornell who I met. Jim was a grad student. He, I think he was an American guy. He had long hair. And during the summertime, I was also at Cornell. So I was working also during the summertime when I was at Cornell. And so I hung out in Ithaca. And Ithaca is just a fabulous town in the summertime. The students primarily are gone. It's much lower key. There's not as much activity. You can go out into the countryside. The countryside is just wonderful, rolling hills, and over like by Watson Glen or the other Finger Lakes. And there are these big waterfalls with pools, and you could go out there and swim in these pools. It was summertime in Ithaca was just magical, just wonderful, and it gave me the time to pursue my interests because I had no teaching responsibilities. I did do some work there in the math department, and so I had income coming in, so to speak. But much less pressure because of the most of the students were not there. And I'll mention somebody else that I met because I was changing living locations there. I'll just say Hari. And anybody who knows the people at Cornell would know this person. And Matt, also a student at the time. Just a few people mentioning by first name, so if they're listening. But interestingly enough, these people came back in my later life to contact me, and so very interesting, very high level intellectual people. So the mixing of intellectuals at this school was just incredible. then in the astrophysics department, one of the people I remember most of all was Ed Salpeter. And he was a cantankerous old guy, very pompous. And I tried to communicate him with a number of times. And his specialty was dealing with the missing mass. Now, if you look at the so-called search for the dark energy and dark matter that is going on today, back in the day, back when I was at Cornell, it was simply called the missing mass. And what had happened is they took light curves, and these light curves are relative to the redshift and the blue shift on the arms of galaxies, and they didn't add up. They didn't add up to a gravitational field. So there was something wrong with the concept of gravity in working in a galaxy. And that's something that I solved, and I actually published my very first peer-reviewed public paper was called Continuing Galactic Evolution. And it's an amazing little paper, and the people who understand what I did in there, it was a mathematical trick in calculus, and what I did is I solved for the arm shapes for all time. You know, a very simple little equation, but it was boiling down these equations from calculus, and they're showing that the stellar material was coming out of the nucleus in a spray, and it was a three-dimensional flow of infalling matter and then the outflowing arms, and that this solved the missing mass problem because the arms of the galaxy were not rotating around like a record disk, but the material was coming out from the center of the galaxy. And so that solved this issue. But anyway, in talking to Ed Salpeter about this, he was extremely angry at me. And when I talked to him, I said, look, this solves the issue of missing mass. And of course, he had spent his career propounding the idea that there was missing mass, which is absurd because there's more missing mass in that you can't see in the galaxy by their model than there is in the nucleus. And it would have to be in this perfectly symmetrical ring. And like, how do you get this? Where does it come from? And of course, they're still dealing with this same issue today. And it's something that I solved mathematically back then, and it is published in a peer-reviewed journal. But Ed Salpeter, and so he was one of the people that I ran into there. Joe Vavirka, what an arrogant jerk. This is a guy who was one of the biggest mouths when the data would come in. After classes, I mentioned meeting up in this auditorium, this big conference hall with the big television screen. And Joe was one of the top NASA scientists, and he was, I suppose he was older than me, but he would be very vocal about anybody would say anything, that doesn't make any sense, or no, we've already figured this out. And he was kind of like there was always, when you get into these scientific groups, there's always the guy with a big mouth. And Joe was the guy with the big mouth. Not too bright, not too good a scientist, but had a big mouth. There was another guy, Brad Smith, and he worked actually at JPL. He was not a Cornell person, but he was the leader of the Voyager spacecraft, the Voyager 1 and 2. And a very good scientist, but also dominated by this idea that there could be no electrical nature of the solar system, etc. But he let some things out in some papers. Now, here's what was going on. As this data would come back, it would get homogenized, blended by the NASA scientists, and then they would publish in Science Magazine or Nature Magazine. Nature is the British version of Science. Science is the U.S. journal. Nature is the British journal. And they would have carte blanche. They would simply publish in there, and there was no peer review. They would simply publish exactly whatever came in. And so there would be usually a science issue and a nature issue dedicated to, say, Voyager 1 at Jupiter with all of this. And Brad Smith let some things through the cracks here. For example, he showed that the Voyager spacecraft showed protons coming off the surface of Jupiter. Well, you know, in the traditional view of Jupiter, why would there be a proton wind coming off Jupiter? And that's what I had been saying in my published papers, is that these were fusion-based objects. And Saturn, my second published, peer-reviewed published paper, was called Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted. And it showed the comet effect, but it had to also, you had to also understand that Saturn was a small fusion-based star, not a planet, and it had a proton wind, and that proton wind created the capacitor, and then the discharge of these small moons is what then acted like a comet and drew in the material from the rings that caused the ring fading. And so anyway, Brad Smith let some of this out in the science articles, which never would have happened if, for example, Carl Sagan really knew what was going on. Hans Bethe. Now, after I realized that my papers were being blackballed in the United States journals, because every journal, they wrote a letter to every journal saying, if McCanny sends something, do not publish it. That's what they did. That's the level of paranoia they had that I would be getting my papers published. So I went up to Hans Bethe, who was a resident scientist at Cornell, and he's friends of Albert Einstein. Hans Bethe was a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who was a resident scientist at Cornell, and they house these people because it's, you know, it's part of the big name, having a Nobel Prize-winning physicist there. And so I got to know Hans, and I'd go up to his office and talk to him about solar physics and also about my dilemma of not being able to publish. So it was Hans that said, here, I'll give you names of people. And so in the British and European journals, basically Zdenek Kopal, it's called Zdenek, but it's pronounced Zdenek without the Z, Zdenek Kopal. And so I sent my papers to him, and he recognized the immense importance of my work, and he refereed them himself and published my papers until they finally got a hold of him. They came down on him, and he contacted me, and he said, wow, these people don't want me to publish your work. And in the letter, he also said, he used the term axioms of astronomy, which is something I picked up, and I called the axioms of astronomy. In his letter to me, he said, it appears that astronomy is more of a religion than a science. That's what he said, and he called them the axioms of astronomy, which would be the Big Bang, the dirty snowball comet model, the fact that there would be no electricity or electrical activity in outer space, and then the last pillar of astrophysics, astronomy, space scientists, that science is that the solar system allegedly formed 4.5 billion years ago in a big collapsing ball of dust and gases, and that nothing has happened since, that all the planets were distinct, that all the moons were in place early in this development of the solar system, and that literally nothing has happened since. So these are the pillars of astronomy that had to be adhered to, and still today, in all theoretical discussions. Tesla criticized this. Einstein criticized this. I, of course, criticized this on campus. And let me just go into this a little bit. This is spring semester of 1981, and I'm already feeling the heat. There, I'm being blackballed for publishing my work, etc. And so, and NASA is getting very protective of the data coming in from the Voyager spacecraft. They know that I'm taking this data and proving them incorrect. And so, anyway, I write a one-page write-up, and I send it around through intercampus mail to all the faculty. Everybody there, research, whether they were faculty teaching or whatever, got a copy of this letter, and I openly accused NASA scientists of faking data, hiding data, to promote their pet theories. And then what I did was I went around campus, door to door, talking to the faculty and the scientists, etc. And wow, this was an eye-opener, because people would talk to me in private, but they would not talk to me in public, because they knew that if they talked to in public about any of this or supported me, that they would be fired. And these were people with tenure, long-term tenure, some of them. etc. And for example, one, I went into the geology department, and the head of the geology department was one of the people that Sagan rounded up for his 1974 American Association for the Advancement of Science, Raus de Velikovsky. The head of the geology department, Cornell, was one of his sidekicks at that deal. So he was very versed in the whole issue of Velikovsky. And by the way, they were not teaching the new upcoming students or faculty anything about Velikovsky. So it was never mentioned on campus. And that's why I could have been there 2 years and never heard a word about this, not knowing that this was fundamentally at the base of everything everybody did. And so I walked into the geology department, and I had a meeting with one of the untenured faculty there who was working for tenure. So I come into the front of the office, and the secretary's there, and I said, I have a meeting with so-and-so. And out of the office of the chairman of the geology department comes this scream, loud enough for everybody to hear, including the guy that was supposed to meet with me. He says, if anybody talks to McCanny, they won't be getting tenure here, if you could make it any more clear. Well, needless to say, the guy didn't come out and talk to me. Then I went to another very striking incident. There was a new department at Cornell, archaeoastronomy. It was just a brand new department, and I'll be talking more about this because it's instrumental because of all of my background in archaeology, etc., that I brought with me, coming from Mexico and the understanding of Quetzalcoatl, who represented Venus, all of this. And so anyway, I went into this office of the chairman of this newly formed department, and he stood up and he shook my hand. He says, I support 100% everything you're doing, but if I say something in public, I will lose my department, I'll lose my job here, and I'll lose everything I've worked for. He says, he said, a lot of people support what you're doing, but he said, none of us can talk because we'll all be thrown out of here, even though we have tenure. Okay, I'm running up on the last minute of this particular show, so next week I'll talk about Icarus, the Cornell Space Science Journal, Joe Burns, Carl Sagan's second wife, Andruyan, who went with him and helped write the Cosmos series with Sagan. And actually, I never met Andruyan, and Carl Sagan, I never saw him personally while I was at Cornell. But it turns out also that Sagan's first wife was a very high-level scientist at Cornell. I never met her either, but she did some very good work, and I won't go into that now, but these are other people at Cornell. And then there was a British scientist who was an independent scientist in the space science department. I'll talk about him next week. So this is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroad. Good night.